Today's talk is given by Australian McCann of RSPB Scotland. His talk is entitled Satellite Remote Sensing for Conservation Action. Dr. McCann is a principal conservation scientist at RSPB Scotland, and his work makes extensive use of spatial data, especially satellite images. That includes monitoring land cover change in sites, such as protected areas and important bird areas, and also species ranges, particularly for the International Union for Conservation of Nature or Ranger listing. Tasks also include work on developing scenarios of land use, land cover, habitat change, and the impact on biodiversity. Graham is also involved in the promotion of geographic information systems, GIS, and remote sensing in conservation. And previous work has included work on upland and moorland bird species, also reed bunting evolutionary ecology, for one, and conservation of the Seychelles and Mauritius. Graham is known to several folk here, so it is a little strange that somehow we have not managed to organise this talk before now. That may be due to his fleeing to work abroad shortly after he helped me with my own dissertation a wee while ago. Well, hopefully not, so this week being overdue, we're therefore very pleased to rectify that, and look forward to a very interesting talk. We'd like to welcome back Graham McCann.
Well, thank you.
And that one,
do you? I've got to, it's mandatory when you give talks. Can you hear me?
Good.
Right. The reason why I've not come back on is because until a few months ago, this book wasn't out, and then now this book is out, I can come back and plug it shamelessly, just in time for Christmas. So as Ford has just said, I do work for the RSPB, the UK Conservation NGO, and in my time at the RSPB, I've become involved in the use of satellite remote sensing for our conservation priority setting and conservation action on the ground. And the background for this is that monitoring is an essential part of conservation, biodiversity conservation. You need to know what is happening where and how quickly in order to devise your conservation response, in order to produce an intervention to address whatever is happening. In vast parts of the world, as is my colleague George Eshimwata, he's doing some biodiversity surveys in Kenya. And this is the traditional way that these data have been collected. It's boots on the ground, people out there with notebooks, writing things down. But the problem is, in vast parts of the world, there is not the capacity to undertake this kind of monitoring. And even in other places, such as the UK, where we do have the capacity, the frequency of which we can undertake this monitoring is not necessarily appropriate for conservation interventions. Consequently, many years ago, the potential of satellite remote sensing was identified as an option to fill in this gap of conservation monitoring and tell us what is happening where in a more timeous manner than necessarily traditional monitoring through boots on the ground would do. I'm quite sure you're all familiar with the concept of satellite remote sensing, being as you work in geosciences, so I won't go into too much detail. But it's a great technique for covering vast parts of the world quickly. We've got, for these days, very high temporal repeat, with the satellite going over, in some cases, multiple times per day. And you've got an increasing spatial resolution with these data as well. When I started, we do not have the data available to us that we have these days. But it's increasingly good quality data at increasing time intervals. This is quite clearly Mount Kenya. This is Mount Kenya in the north of Kenya. And you can see, as we zoom down through the different levels of data, we can get a clearer picture as to what's happening in the northern side of this protected area. And we can see how agriculture is expanding slowly into the park. This is quite a big agricultural area, but there's also smaller shamba system, the more slash and burn systems going on in the this area here, which is where you're getting some of the encroachment. So we can get great information out of these images. Let's say it's quite a while ago since the potential of satellite remote sensing in conservation and ecology was recognised. If we go back to 1969, time of moon landings, the first paper on the topic was published in a peer-reviewed journal called Remote Sensing and Ecology. And since then, there have been pulses of papers coming out as new data have become available, or new funding has come online, or a group of communities have identified the potential of this as a data source. This slide stops at 2014 because the person I nicked off didn't wasn't updated subsequent to that, but it does also just come to a point there where the potential of satellite remote sensing, the number of papers coming out of the potential satellite remote sensing, began to dwindle off. So for a big number of years, it was a rite of passage to write a comment paper or an essay or some other type analysis and publish it in a peer-reviewed journal saying, we should be doing more with satellite remote sensing in conservation. We can do more with satellite remote sensing in conservation. These are the topics we should be doing more at. And there was a pulse of these papers again around about 5 years ago, ten years ago. But thankfully they've now tailed off, because instead of people saying we should be doing more with satellite remote sensing and conservation, we're now at the stage where we are doing things with satellite remote sensing and conservation, and it's no longer necessary to call people to action. If you look at the number of papers published on biodiversity conservation and remote sensing or Landsat, see how the number has gone up very, very rapidly over the past 10 years, 15 years. Obviously, some of this is due to the increase in the number of papers being published full stop, but even the percentage of papers on the topic of biodiversity conservation that have the expression remote sensing in them, that has been going up steadily as well. So a great proportion of academic studies are using remote sensing. Not necessarily satellite remote sensing, I'll give you that, but the majority of them are satellite remote sensing. So it's increasingly represented in the literature, but representation in the scientific literature does not necessarily indicate uptake in the real world and application of satellite remote sensing. It's fine to publish a novel study using satellite remote sensing on biodiversity monitoring in the peer-reviewed literature, but that doesn't really get us any further forward in terms of conservation. And coming from an applied conservation background and applied background, that's what I'm more interested in. Not the nice proof of concept, but the actual application, turning science into application. So, in 2015, myself and my friend, my colleague Alison Ledner, who works for NASA, were at a conference in Montpellier, a conservation biology conference in Montpellier. And at this conference, we had a symposium where we were bringing together people who were actually using satellite remote sensing in an ongoing, what we call, operational way to inform conservation action on the ground or conservation policy. And this was a very well-attended symposium within the conference. There was another couple of symposium saying how we should be using satellite remote sensing, but we went for the more direct, we are using it. Let's start to celebrate it a little bit. And on the back of this symposium, Cambridge University Press, foolishly, asked us if we would like to pull together various case studies and produce a book on the topic. We were delighted with this prospect, because it enabled us to get on and say we are using satellite remote sensing. We can demonstrate the potential. We don't have to publish papers saying it has potential anymore, but it is actually being used. So, if you do want to buy the book in time for Christmas, it's got 10 chapters in it. Before we start with a brief introduction to conservation and sensing. And each of the case studies then goes through details, examples of where the authors have been using satellite remote sensing and actually informed conservation activity, conservation action on the ground. When we originally conceived the group, we hoped these would all be ongoing studies. That wasn't the case in all cases, because funding didn't come through for all of them, which still indicates what one of the problems is. People fund science, but people don't fund ongoing use of these tools. But the majority of these tools are still going on and are being used to inform wildlife management and conservation action on the ground. So what I'm going to do is just go through two or three of these case studies and then get to the end and discuss some of the instances, some of the lessons learned from all of these chapters and recurring themes that come out of all of these chapters. We do this to try and inform future activities, future projects within this area in terms of what difficulties people had and what they learned from the process. We produced this book very much with the intention of stimulating people to think about these topics and get them working and identify some of the problems that they might come across and how to get over them. So this is a very, very scaled down introduction to satellite remote sensing, because I'm assuming that pretty much everyone in this room knows how it works. It measures reflected solar radiation generally in terms of passive remote sensing. We haven't considered active remote sensing within this book. I'll come on to that later on. But this is a very similar, a very simplified version of how it all works. But I'll skip over that because I assume you know it. Instead, I'll come on to a paper published in 2012 by Rob Rose and various co-authors, where they went through and identified 10 ways satellite remote sensing can contribute to conservation. Not necessarily the 10 ways, or the 10 most important ways, but 10 ways of particularly prevalent in discussions among the conservation community at the time. And it's a very useful framework to work with in terms of this, because it tells us what the needs are, what the potential applications are. And this paper that Rob et al. Produced was a bit of a plea for having focus work in these areas. But what Alison and I realised is that there are a lot of these areas that are already, work is already going on in. For starters though, for our book, we have not considered climate change, phenology change, because that's such a massive topic that's well out of our league that deserves the book in itself. Similarly, we've not considered ecosystem service monitoring, because again, that's a massive topic. And you could fill the book alone by red plus examples. We've not got any red plus examples in this book either. Instead, we focus upon the less headline-grabbing applications of satellite remote sensing for conservation. So, just starting with the first couple here, agriculture and agricultural expansion and changes in land use and land cover and degradation and disturbance of regimes. Two or three of the chapters focused upon these particular topics, but the one I'm going to focus upon here is a chapter by Rick Murray. There you go, you can go now, Pete. He just came along to see this picture. Now, the coastlines, the mudflats of Southeast Asia, the coastal wetlands, are a hugely important ecosystem. They're a huge carbon store. They're massively important for biodiversity, support a big range of species. And a huge number of passage waders, birds, that breed in the Arctic, pass down the coast of East Asia, and then head on to Australia, New Zealand, or round into India and Thailand, Burma, to spend winter. These wetlands are of huge importance. Something like 1% of the entire world's birds population of waders pass through some of these wetlands. It's an astonishing number of birds up there. And this bird is one of them, spoonbill sandpiper. It breeds in Chukotka in Russia and winters all around Southeast Asian coasts, Burma, into Thailand, across into Bangladesh, where if you spend the winter off of China. And it's a species that's population declined massively over the past few years. It was going down at 25% per annum few years back, and obviously that's not sustainable. The population in nosedive. This is a real shame. And one of the reasons for this was potentially loss of mudflat in and around China. A study suggested that about 50% went between 1950 and 2000, which is a massive loss of habitat for any species. I'm just waffling because it's such a great bird. So, the mudflats of Southeast Asia. Couple of types. You've got dendritic waterways that form these slightly more complicated ones shown in figure A, and these big, flat, extensive mudflats shown in figure B there. Both types are under threat by reclamation for urbanisation, or for agriculture, for fish farm development, or for airports. There's been a huge amount of loss of habitat. This image here on the left is an area just north of Shanghai. And you can see how active the reclamation is going on. They're just walling off big areas of the mudflats. And in this case, it's in filled fish ponds. In this case, it's rice paddies. This reclamation is going on rapidly, but nobody knew where it was happening or how extensive it was. So Nick and his colleagues took data from Landsat sensors, going back to the 1990s, and produced composites and looked at when the high tide and the low tide occurred. and through a remarkably simple algorithm, they just identified, based upon NVWI, water index, wetness index, they identified when it was wet and then when it was dry. And based upon that, produced the estimate of mud flap at time t, and then they did it again at time t plus 1, and they got a map of mud flap loss. Mud flaps within the area and mud flap loss. And you can see the figure on the left there. I should have asked, do you have a little laser pointer, or do I have to use this device? I'm not going to use the pointer stick. So you can see how extensive they are around some areas. Key clusters of an area. This is the area that I showed you the slide of a couple of minutes ago. And they go all the way around. Oh, don't worry, Owen, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. Leave it. It's not worth it. All the way up around the Canadian Peninsula onto around China, the Yellow Sea, Bohai Sea. And these are extensive areas which are also massive centres of urbanisation and population expansion. And so they're massively at risk. And what Nick and his colleagues found was that the tidal mudflats of East Asia were going at a rate that exceeds the rate of tropical deforestation in Africa and the rate of tropical deforestation in Latin America, and it's approaching the rate of tropical deforestation in Southeast Asia. For anyone who knows anything, tropical deforestation in Southeast Asia is happening rapidly, scarily quickly. So this is one of these things that's been quite undetected, unknown about, overlooked in terms of conservation. And it is important, not just for the birds, but there's ecosystem services associated with these mudflats. There's carbon storage in these mudflats. And there's livelihoods associated with these mudflats. The key thing about this study, what we liked about this study, was that it has gone on to directly inform a whole load of conservation action and activities. It's fed into multiple meetings, East Asian Flyways Partnership. It's fed into IUCN assessments. It's fed into CBD assessments as well. And these data are being used for conservation. Unfortunately, they've not got the money to continue this monitoring, which is a real shame, because it'd be a brilliant tool if we could. But it's quite a simple tool that has been able to identify mudflats, where mudflats have been lost. And indeed, some of the follow-on work from this, improved protected area management in China. At the time that Nick wrote this chapter, he had low confidence that this was going to influence Chinese policy. But some subsequent work that we've been doing has subsequently had an impact. And based upon some of the analysis of these mudflat loss work, the Chinese government have agreed to extend protection of some of the sites up the coast near Shanghai, which is great news. It's nice when these things actually get used and actually have an impact. So, three of the other topics that Rob considered, species distribution and abundance, species movements and life stages, and conservation effectiveness. Conservation effectiveness is quite an important topic here because what we do, we've got limited resource, limited money, and so conservation is a standard take actions. We need to know they're working in order so that we can modify what we're doing, so we get a feedback cycle in order to improve the activities which we're undertaking. So this is quite an important topic to be including in these kinds of studies. Blue whales. Lessons learned from Whale Watch. A tool using satellite data to provide near real-time predictions of whale occurrence. Up the west coast of America, there's a vast number of whales migrate there. Vast. Okay, not that many, but there are a considerable number of whales migrate up there. Blue whales, humpback whales, grey whales. And a major source of mortality in these whales is known to be collisions with ships, and additionally for humpback whales, entanglement in fishing kit. Blue whales, despite their vast size, can also get entangled in fishing kit as well. But realising the impact that collisions with ships can have on whale populations, NOAA and the US government funded a study, a tool, to look at producing a near real-time monitoring tool so that shipping could identify areas where there's a high probability of whale occurrence and avoid them. Demographic modelling suggested that a collision rate of 2.3 whales per annum would result in the blue whale population off the west coast of America declining. So this is really, really fine margins. any tools which will help us reduce these collisions are going to be a benefit. If only every author for the book presented a really nice schematic like this that shows exactly how the system works in one slide. They brought together Argus satellite tag data from the whale movements to produce a model of distribution of whales in relation to oceanographic conditions, wind, sea surface temperature, chlorophyll, etc. Whale distribution can pretty much be predicted if you know where krill are. Whales go where krill go, and if you can model the distribution of krill, you can therefore model the distribution of whales and direct shipping away from it, predict density and direct shipping away from the area. So this brought together two emerged technologies. First of all, satellite tag whales. They needed the data from these whales in order to identify where the whales are going. Satellite tag data was used in preference to ship-based observations because ship-based observations of distribution are biased to when the observation was actually made and where the ship was at the time. But the satellite data, while fewer individuals may be tagged, provides a great source of data for these analyses. They pulled together ocean data from a vast range of sensors. I put the book away, so I can't tell you what they all were. EBHRR, SeaWaves, MODIS, a huge, huge range of sensors with data going quite far back in time. And the availability of these data going back to the 1990s was a benefit because it enabled them to get a really accurate idea as to what was going on with these whales. Having this vast time series going back to some time is a useful tool for understanding the distribution, how the distribution could be changing over time. And then going forward, we can start using the better calibrated models. this data are presented online using a user-friendly interface, so to say. It is quite user-friendly as well. You just go to this website, and the potential distribution of whales comes up in front of you. And NOAA Fisheries, West Coast Region, can identify the areas where shipping should be avoiding, and ships themselves can be identifying the areas they should be avoiding. And this has massively reduced collision rate with whales. Based upon observations and the dead whales which have been found and washed up, since this system was implemented, the number of whales which have been hit each year has gone down. So we know it is working. We know it is having an impact, unlike the ships. A couple of other things. Rapid response and protected area management, another area. A lot of conservation is reactive. The worse the problem is, the more difficult it is to develop a response to and to halt. The more that's gone wrong, the more that it's been degraded, the more difficult it is to restore, and the more embedded the driver of change. So if you can respond rapidly to a problem, there's a greater likelihood of being able to nip it in the bud. Now, on protected areas, which are sites of conservation importance, which have been defined, you've often got the capacity to respond to these areas. You've often got the capacity to respond to the changes which you're detecting. Fire monitoring is a very well established application for satellite remote sensing. The temperature of the fire gives back a very, very particular spectral signature. And using satellites which have got rapid repass a couple of times, four times a day, you can detect active fires quite easily. And this is a system that's developed by people at JRC, ECJRC in Italy, which has been going for a number of years now and is being used on a regular basis to inform protected area management within Africa. There's a range of ecosystem types, but across a large part of Africa, the ecosystems are either fire dependent, which is dark colouring, or fire colour, or fire sensitive, which means that fire can have an impact on the vegetation there, which impacts on the whole ecosystem there. So a lot of the areas of Africa are very susceptible to inappropriate burning, whether it's too much burning or too little burning. And protected area management plans identify the correct level of burning in order to maintain the current vegetation type. But in order to determine whether this is actually happening, people need to know which areas are being burnt when. We also need to know if all burns which are happening are prescribed burns or natural burns. Protected areas in Africa are often vast. If you look at Selous Park, which is the one shown in the red on the left-hand image there. That's in Tanzania. I can't remember how big it is, but it is multiple Wales's in size. And there's just not enough capacity to be able to monitor the whole park. This is quite typical of a lot of these areas. So being able to get these data from MODIS delivered to the park managers enables them to determine whether the annual fire burning regime is working or whether there are aseasonal fires, which would indicate illegal activity within the park. There are an awful cases now of where illegal fire activity has been used by park managers to identify problem areas and take action against encroachment into parks or to halt inappropriate management. Inappropriate activities that are going in the parks. The other thing about fire detection is that poachers often use fires to drive wildlife to wherever they've got their guns or their nets. And so unexpected burns or out-of-season burns can also be a very good indication of poaching activity, and it is quite widely used as an anti-poaching tool as well. It's not just for Celis in Eastern Africa. This is Park W in Niger as well, where there's quite a lot of fire occurrence going on. Oh, I thought I had another slide there. But what I meant to say was that these data, a lot of these protected areas are not online. They have very, very limited internet connection in large parts of Africa. So it's part of this system for selected protected areas or selected regional areas. They have installed satellite dishes so that these data are bounced from the JRC satellite and down to satellite receiving stations, very localized satellite receiving stations at each protected area or regional protected area offices. So this is a way of getting these data to where they're going to be used, because Aegis produces it as an online tool. Unlike the whale watch tool, where America online connected, large parts of Africa aren't. So you've also got to, in some cases, invest in infrastructure so that these data can be made available to the people who want to be using them, rather than just putting them into space and hoping that somebody uses them. It does take some intervention and investment in technology as well. So I'll skip this one. Now it brings us on to common themes and some lessons learned and some implications. So, in the process of pulling this book together, Alison and I noticed some common themes coming out again and again and again. And we thought that some of these could be some of the most valuable content of the book in terms of informing people for the future who might want to start these activities, who might have ideas that need to learn. Just need a little bit of a shove, a stimulus to people, just to help them through the process. Not in a patronising way, but it's just some tools, some things came out of this. Collaboration was the first one that came out, it jumped out at us. Very early on, getting all stakeholders together and discussing what needs to be done, how the data needs to be presented, how often, and what the information should be. There's no point in academics coming off and producing some very, very fancy index of education health, which means absolutely nothing to a park manager on the ground. So having a collaboration between people who are going to be using these data and the people who are producing them, and also the people who are going to be distributing these data, bringing everyone together very, very early on in the process is how you're going to end up making best use of these data. And this is a very important one: free, open and accessible data. Back in 2007-2008, NASA, USGS announced that Landsat data were going to be made freely available. The historical archive was going to be opened up. This made higher resolution data, 30 meter resolution data, freely available to the conservation community for the first time. Coarser resolution data have previously been available, but Landsat does seem to have turned into a workhorse for the conservation community. Landsat 8 came out as well, and continuation of the free data policy. And since then, Sentinel, the European Space Agency, Sentinel data through the Copernicus project are also free at a similar resolution, in addition to PROBE-V and the MODIS data. This is vital. Conservationists do not have money. You may think that it's, well, USGS have just recently discussed the possibility of starting to charge for data again, and they were floating various ideas about $100 per image, or even $1 per image. If you look at some of the global applications now going on that we're using, for example, Manhattan's deforestation map that I've not mentioned here, that takes hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of images. And if you start charging even $1 an image, that is going to start limiting access to these data. Free, open, and accessible data. Taxpayers, we've paid for these satellites to be launched. There are issues with charging us twice for these data. There's something that came out to us as well, slightly surprised by this. Spatial and temporal resolution of satellite observations and the types of observations used. When I say slightly surprised, initially we were surprised, we thought about it and realised it makes perfect sense. A lot of these studies have used MODIS data, which is a kilometre, 500 metres, or some of the probe data, 300 metres. It's quite coarse resolution. A few years ago, if you spoke to the conservation community, you asked them, what do you want? Well, we want very, very high resolution data. Okay, you might want this, but you're not using it. It's down to Landsat's resolution of data, what are being used. So this expectation between the policy side of conservation as to what data they want to be using and the actual application side in terms of developing these products is a bit of a mismatch there. And so going down in spatial resolution probably isn't going to help the conservation community that much more. It makes sense when you think about it, because it takes more processing for the higher resolution data, it takes more download time, you cover a smaller area with each image, there's more image processing involved, and the back catalogue is not necessarily as good. For some of the coarser resolution data, it goes way back to 2,000 images every day, 10 days. So it's not really a surprise that these data are quite coarse, and it just takes a lot less time to be processing them. So this call for very high resolution data, possibly not actually what is needed in conservation. It is better temporal resolution of lower resolution, spatial resolution data. This is what I'm talking about. If I remember this slide was in here, I'd have put it up to demonstrate my point. MODIS 500 meter data all the way to the Sentinel 2 10 meter data. It might very well be that as time goes on, this uptake of the 10 meter resolution data increases as processing power increases and the back catalogue increases as well. But it does seem for the time being that it is the coarser resolution data which are being used. Another important thing, building and enabling capacity. It's very nice, it's fine to spend millions of pounds upon a fancy data set or a fancy tool, but unless you develop the capacity for people to use this data, to use these tools, you're wasting your money. You're coming up with something fancy that is going to sit nowhere, a bit like my book actually, a lot of time and money over something that's all going to be pointless. You've got to build the capacity to enable people to use these data. And the example with the fires is a great example of this. Not only did they put in the satellite receiving stations, but they also went around and provided training for people on how to use these data, how to use the receiving stations. And they did it in English and they did it in French, making training manuals available in English, in a language other than English, in another vital, very small step to increasing the uptake of these data. And if you do this, uptake does seem to be greater. The establishment of tools is one of the people we're going to. It does seem to increase the more you build the capacity. This is related to the above thing, is customized tool development of visualizations. Keep it simple. Make a simple tool so people can easily and intuitively understand what's going on. It's a fairly basic thing you're all going to understand, but scientists can get a little bit focused upon developing something that's really high-tech or describe something really complicated. But for somebody on the ground trying to manage a protected area, they don't need to know that. They just need to know change, yes, no, wetter, drier. Some simple thing like that is, in many, many cases, what you need to know. When you know nothing, it's better to know some very simple things that you can understand intuitively. This involves in bringing in all stakeholders at the very, very start of the process. the examples that we put up and some of the other examples that we've come across brought everybody together at the very, very start of the process and discussed how the data are going to be presented at the end. Rather than getting halfway through the project and thinking, very good, how are we going to present them, work it out at the very, very start of your tool development. The Whale Watch example is a great example of where this worked very well, as is the JRC example of the fire. Nice, simple understand tools. This one here is for an example of not put up from one of the other chapters that looked at harvest rates of mule deer over time. It's a fairly simple tool with nice little sliders, and based upon where you put the sliders, you can get estimates as to how many mule deer hunting licenses you can provide within an area. It's a very simple tool that was developed with the people who are actually going to be using it. In situ and Earth observations. The whale example showed very well that Earth observation, satellite remote sensing, is not a panacea for conservation problems. It was sold as such a few years ago. This has caused all sorts of problems subsequently. But in order to calibrate their images, you need to know what's happening on the ground. You need to know what the data refer to. So it's vital to have the in-situ ground data as well as the Earth observation data to calibrate the models and to give you a better understanding of what's going on in the ground, to give it some footing in the real world. And the last one was one that Alistair and I discussed quite a fair bit. We phrased it as a role for serendipity. A lot of the chapters said, by luck, it just so happened that so-and-so had met somebody who was working on a similar project at a conference, or we happened to know an individual who'd just done this, or we remembered a paper published in. Now, you could think this is serendipity, a bit of luck, or, and Alison and I thought about it and discussed it a little bit more. It's not. It's hard work. The way you know that that paper was published in an obscure journal is keeping up with the literature. The way you know what other people have been working on is going to conferences and networking and meeting people. So, a multiple of the chapters said, fortunately, or in fortuitous circumstances, we don't think so. We reckon that the final common theme lesson learned from education is you've got to work hard and know what other people are up to in the field and keep an eye on the other literature in order to keep abreast of what other people are doing and bring their ideas in. Luck doesn't come into it quite so much. Finish on a quick look to the future. As I say at the start of this, the potential of satellite remote sensing and conservation is no longer a proof of concept thing. We've got to get beyond that. Yes, academic research can still work upon forwarding an understanding of what's going on in the environment, producing new tools in the future, but we should also be using it now to inform what's going on. We need to know what is happening now rather than waiting on a slightly more advanced tool. Let's start with what we can do, and then we can build upon that in the future. There's going to be more sensors and data available, increasing number of data available through, well, Copernicus is a great example of the data that's going to be available to us. We've got radar data available to us now. None of the chapters used that. We've got LiDAR data possibly available in the future. There's going to be more processing needs associated with that. But we've got to expect a lag in uptake in use. It's got to go from the sensor to scientists, remote sensing community, conservationists. There is going to be a small lag in their uptake and production of tools. In many cases, we're going to have to build up a back catalogue of data in order to start looking at changes, to see how things are changing over time using some of these tools. Or we're going to have to build up a back catalogue of data to produce models which we have statistical and biological belief in. So we can expect a lag in uptake. Radar data have been freely available for a wee bit of time now, but they're still not routinely used in ongoing conservation remote sensing. Why is that? Possibly because they're a wee bit scary, they're a wee bit more complicated, they're less intuitive to understand, but as remote sensing is taught more routinely in conservation courses as part of MSCs, these data, we would expect these data to start being used more often in the tools in the future. We can look forward to stronger collaborations, definitely. The more examples we have of people working together, that's going to take stronger and stronger collaborations. Especially with the drive in academia at the moment for user uptake, applied studies, I think this is a great thing in terms of developing collaborations between the universities and the conservation organisations. earlier today I was at a meeting in Botanical Gardens where we were bringing together conservation community, Edinburgh University people, and it's just really obvious that there is the willingness there for the collaborations to be occurring. Tools and end-user engagement. There's no point in putting out something complicated in a scientific paper. That's not going to get picked up. If you're developing something worthwhile, it'd be nice to have a tool and get end-user engagement in it, involved at the start of the process, so that the tools and the data that come out of it are going to be more usable. In the future, we're all got smartphones. They weren't there 15 years ago. These things are going to come from people's phones, park managers' phones. You're not going to need little base stations or steering stations for your fire data. This kind of thing is going to increase. Democratisation of data is going to go on in the future. But most of all, what Alison and I hope comes out of this is inspiration and encouragement for people to try and turn some of their ideas, their concepts and their research into tools, and also for the conservation community to go to the research, the remote sensing community, and start the discussions, dialogues and collaborations which we're going to need in order to turn some of these ideas into actual tools. What Alison and I finished on at the end of the book is we really look forward to 10 years' time, 9 years now, coming along and updating this book and seeing how far we've come in the intervening period of 10 years to see what else is available. It might not take this far, but I'm certainly looking forward to doing that and finding out what's happened in the intervening period. There you go, Ewan. Sorry, Owen. That's 45 minutes. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Did we download images and process them the old-fashioned way, or are there other ways of doing it that might may help the USGS start charging in?
So if the Landsat data appear in the Google Earth Engine, someone's going to have to pay them, and Google aren't going to do that. So it is going to affect the Google Engine. You're absolutely right. In the past few years, we've seen cloud processing. Google Earth Engine in particular is a great tool. It's something that we did touch on. The availability of these images online means that you just need a reasonable internet connection. Previously, in large parts of the world, the internet connections have just not been up to downloading images. And once you have downloaded two or three images, you do not have these processing capabilities locally to process them locally. So Google Earth Engine is going to probably make a very big difference. We did some work, a colleague in South Africa and I did some work last year, looking at the capacity of conservationists and universities in Africa to use satellite remote sensing data. We found that this is going to be something that's going to make a big difference. Internet connections and the ability to process data using Google Earth Engine. JavaScript isn't necessarily the most user-friendly language, which is the block at the moment in terms of using these data. The other thing about Google Earth Engine is we don't know how long it's going to be free for. Google is a business, chances are they're going to start charging at some point, but until then, you should be making full use of it, definitely. So.
Well, camera. I'm much older than most people here, back in the early 80s, in the days of the late lamented Nature Conservancy Council, we were sold satellite imagery as the answer to all of our prayers. It was going to fix everything for us. 30 years later, when I retired, I never really got the impression that that had happened particularly. So, what is your understanding of the position in Scotland, and is it actually being used in any significant way nowadays?
So this is a problem insofar as 30 years ago, satellite remote sensing became a thing, it appeared, and some people thought, great, this is going to solve all our problems, and they promoted it as such, and those higher up tried it, it didn't solve all the problems, it went like this in the keyboard, obviously, it didn't solve their problems, and this has left a legacy, and the people who are now deciding what projects to fund, or the direction of conservation organisations, the senior management, they remember this time 15, 20 years ago when satellite imagery didn't solve all their problems. and they're a block in terms of funding these applications. They remember when it didn't work, and they say, dismiss, oh, that didn't work 20 years ago, it's not going to work now. But we've come such a long way. The data are at a higher resolution, the temporal resolution has gone up, the processing capabilities have gone up, the algorithms have improved. And so, yeah, we are in a far better place. SNH now are using satellite data. They might be slightly overselling it, but they are using satellite remote sensing data in their work now. So, yes, we're at a stage now where it is there, it is being used by static chains. And that's only going to increase as the generation who were told this will solve all your problems but were disappointed, they retire. But the people who are new to it and the people who've got a can-do attitude, they'll come in and will make even more use of it. So there is a legacy issue there. You're absolutely right to highlight that. There is a legacy issue.
You mentioned when deciding between temporal resolution, spatial resolution is key for conservation and for ecological monitoring. But you kind of were a bit dismissive with the higher and higher spatial resolution because Landsat is used so widely. But surely that higher spatial resolution, if we start collecting it now, okay, it might not be used in conservation for, say, 10 years, but as the cost of high-power computing comes down, as machine learning comes online, these things become much more accessible to people who don't have very exact, like, very specific training. The longer we can get that high resolution time scale going, even if it's not being used this year or next year, the more valuable it's going to be in 10 or 20 years.
Yes, sorry, I didn't mean to be dismissive. I'm talking about Landsat data, 30 metres, is a very variable downloadable data source. We've got the Global Forest Map, we've got JRC's water body tool, two global products which rely on Landsat data, and that vast back catalogue of data. Without that, we couldn't be doing that. I didn't mean to dismiss Landsat, I was more thinking about the quick birds and the sub-metre resolution data that the conservation community said, oh, this is what we want to look at 40 centimetres. You give them that image, you give them however many megabytes, and don't know what to do with it. You can't process it. So you're right, in time, yeah, these quick bird images and such, like once we get the processing algorithms, once we get the storage capacity, etc., etc., we will start becoming valuable. But it's just noticeable that the mismatch between what the conservation policy, what the conservation want was, when they say we need high, very high resolution images, and what's actually being used. It's very, very noticeable this match. But you're right, over time, as capacity increases, we'll be starting to probably use the higher resolution images. There's also a thing of scale which you want to monitor, because you're getting down to 40 centimetres. What's that actually telling you? It might be that the wavelengths of 30 metres are explaining exactly the characteristics that you want to be looking at, and that 40 centimetre resolution isn't adding anything. It's a possibility. There's a paper a few years ago that said 30 metre resolution is optimal for monitoring land cover change, and it's going to start paying higher. Whether or not that proves to be right in the long run, I don't know, but I'm not dismissing Landsat. The back catalogue of Landsat data is fantastic. Let's keep it free.
You mentioned combining remote sensing data with in-situ measurements, but do you also include nowadays, drone measurements, for example, or other airborne measurements?
We didn't touch on this, but there's a huge number of UAV data available, and they're valuable in terms of calibrating higher resolution, coarser satellite data. Yeah, they are a valuable source of data, definitely. They're going to become more readily used.
But there's none of the case studies have been applied.
It's only in the past 5 years that. UAVs have become available and received as big in 2015 and so no, none of these studies have used that at the moment. But when we come to update it, if we do update it, it could be that it's all about UAVs.
Well, using today's UAVs, look back in time if there's a linkage between satellite images.
So that's an interesting thing. The fact that it's ESA and USGS NASA who produce store all of these satellite images on one central repository. They're accessible to anybody. whereas the UAV data are all held on different organisation servers, and the hard disk goes, and you lose the data. It's a data accessibility issue there.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to make sure that those data are conserved.
Yeah, so how do we ensure that conservation organisations have access to the latest products and services?
Whenever USGS put up a survey about asking how much to charge for Landsat, click the free bike button. So we've got Copernicus. ESA have committed to me to free availability of Copernicus. But if that lasts, we don't know. The more we use these data, and the more that space agencies see that we're using these data, the greater the likelihood that they're made free. That's the simple solution.
And what's the easiest way at the moment to access that most recent information?
It depends what you want to. If you want ESA data, go to the Copernicus portal. If you want Landsat or Sentinel data, go to Earth Explorer. I can't remember what it is these days. It is Earth Explorer. Keep on changing these anyway, you just have a go there. Fast amounts of data. Earth Explorer or Copernicus.
So do you get any deals, conservationists get deals on hard disk or cloud storage if you're storing UAV imagery over the whole world?
I don't know what goes on in that. I don't do anything with UAVs.
I don't quite know, is the business model, I mean, the more often the more use, I'm thinking that it's more use, the lower the cost per unit of business speed. But you're seeing their data being used is one thing. How do they make revenue from use? Is there a way to influence that?
Who? Sorry.
Well, the data providers, you said that the more that they see the data being used, the more likely to make free. But what's just thinking in raw economic terms, the benefit to them?
That's just blind optimism. Because their funding depends upon the use of the data that they produce. So for space agencies, if nobody's using the data they produce, their funding gets halted. If people aren't using it, their funding gets halted.
It goes back to central. Any more for any more? I don't know how the weather's doing out there. It's supposed to be yet another storm. It's about once upon a day. Maybe we'll let Graham off the hook that we have a phenomenal collection of beer available. We do often retire onto other hostelries, which you're most welcome to hang around if you can, and we'll see what happens. We don't have a major plan. We usually go to TV at Library Bar, some of the GIS folks, other people. So we'll just maybe stay here for a bit. You're welcome to join, finish off the refreshments, and you can see we'll take a rain check, literally. But at that point, I think we'll just say thank you all for coming for the Christmas special. Thanks to Hutton Club for coming out, volunteers for setting up. Thanks again, and thanks, of course, to Graham for a very interesting talk.